anybody doesn't want to hang in the background.
So I have a question.
Question. Identify name, rank, serial number.
Yeah, I'm Max. I'm one of the Futures
Salon.
Futures people.
Yeah.
Have you heard of the game Spore?
Spore is going to be a wonder. I'm signed up and waiting for the beta, hoping it'll come soon.
Do you have any idea like how detailed they're getting into like the genetic algorithms?
I don't know. I talked about this with Will Wright about 5 years ago because he knew about the Biota project and he talked about wanting to do something, but I haven't seen it at all. It's probably very game-like because it's got to be a commercial success at some level. Yeah. I think A-Life games could be incredibly boring.
Yeah.
If they're...
Can you speak a bit louder for us?
Spore was a player-driven evolution. You earn points, and you choose the changes that you want to make to your creature.
Okay.
Versus I'm assuming the previous models you were showing were made with genetic algorithms.
Genetic algorithms, yeah. And in fact, I've heard Spore described as massively single-player. So it's just you and all these creatures. And Sim City and all those other, and Sim Ant. Yeah.
I was wondering, like,
who are you?
My name's Med, M-E-D. I'm sort of, I guess, loosely involved with the whole futures thing. But I'm wondering, like, what sort of...
Actually, if you hold this, we'll get sound.
Oh.
The miracle of miracles.
Okay. What sort of... parameters do you vary to have, like, that kind of genetic algorithm where you have just blocks of almost any shape connected at almost any point, turning at different kinds of, how do you do something like that?
You can actually download his algorithms and his papers from the web, and some people have sort of recreated it. And really, it's directed graphs more than a... Like, Tom raised here was little rows and sequences of numbers. This is more like... You know, A to B and B to C, and messages move along the graph, and they tell you about how to make the body and how to run it. And so that graph is then slightly changed, like the distance between A and B, and that makes a longer or shorter leg. And also tells you how the legs are connected. So it's all graphs.
Thank you for the talking stick. I'm Miguel Esnar, one of the moderators for the Santa Cruz Future Salon, and the Director of Education for Foresight Nanotech Institute. Some of the descriptions I've seen for exploring beyond the Earth don't take either of the approaches that you describe, either sending bodies out with the magazines and toilets and so on, or in developing directed mold that can live out there, but somehow uploading consciousness to nanoscale machines so that we can go without the magazines and toilets and so on. How does that fit into your view of what's possible?
That's a very good question. I think even it's very interesting because uploading consciousness, you'd have to say, what is consciousness? And even the consciousness conference can't define that. And I think that's so far, that's so fuzzy an idea as to be... You can't even ask the questions from an engineering standpoint at all. It's just a non-answerable question with no answer. Ray Kurzweil hired me about 4 years ago to do statistics on processor speed increases for his book that just came out. And because of the DigiBarn project, and with every little curve that I showed him, I'm like, well, here's 3D chipsets. You know, here's their curve. And here's processor from the very beginning, from the Intel 8080. And some of those charts are in the book. I wrote long pieces to Ray about why this is meaningless, why you should not use these figures. And Ray's not a scientist at all. So he took the things that showed his, mainly it's a philosophy, it's mainly science fiction what it is. And all of the arguments, like for example, in 1981, you could sit in front of a Xerox Star computer, which was the first computer with trash bins and folders and stuff, and pretty much do what you do today, a little slower and whatever, but you did email and internet and whatever. And that machine was 1/1000th of the power of a current Pentium 4, but it utilized the CPU 80% of the time. And you sit in front of your Pentium 4, you can actually see that CPU is used like 2, 3, 4, 5% of the time. So it's like over 90% of this improved processor performance is just no-op instructions, not used. Game environments are different because you're always driving every visual pixel. But I really argue with Ray is that you can't conclude that software is going to be somehow a magical medium to that will evolve into a thing as complex as a consciousness. It just isn't happening. Nobody's driving it. Software, like any other industry, is now in this great shuddering stall phase of the lack of evolution. The progress in software was happening in the 70s, and when you get monopolies and standardization, you get a sudden slowdown of a medium. It happened in aircraft, it happened in radios, it happened in automobiles, it's happened in computers and networks now. The interface on your cell phone is effectively one that you could have seen in the mid-70s in the lab. And the code bases are so big and so cumbersome, and you have to support so much stuff that you can't evolve software. Yeah. So my conclusion was, since we don't know what consciousness is, we can't decrypt what's in here and how this works, and you can't separate what's in here from the complexity of the world, and you can't even simulate that. We try that with the lunar environment. You can't even simulate the movement of lunar soil under a wheel. It's too big of a problem to do it accurately. That you may as well give up on that approach and go to the approach of saying, hey, that slime mold or that single-celled bacterium, we can actually study that. We might actually be able to build a model and replicate how that really works in a simple environment. And we may be able to really do engineering at that simple level and build up from there, or let it build a system that can evolve and make a slime mold that's a little bit better, a digital slime mold.
Okay, so let's give up on consciousness for a minute. What about using genetic algorithms and our understanding of genetics to make better terraforming, like for Mars? Like, couldn't we do a better job at terraforming Mars and terraforming our bodies to suit that new atmosphere we're creating?
I think that's probably a viable approach. In the first, back in the original example, was you can get a dirty ice ball into orbit.
Yeah.
You get your little lichens out. And what did lichens do 2 billion years ago or 1 billion years ago? Lichens, if you go and blow up a big piece of dynamite anywhere on the planet and expose bare rock, so it's kind of like primordial, what is the first thing that comes there? Lichens. If it's the right environment. These little things, and they're little factories. And they're very simple. People just don't pay any attention to them. They're pretty primitive. They can live inside nuclear reactor shells. I mean, these things are incredible. They start to, on the top is a photosynthetic layer. They're green on top, and there's a black layer on the bottom. The black layer is eating away the rock. The top layer is getting the energy. It's a synergistic organism. And that's, I think, if you just look at that example and say, wow, that's terraforming right there. That's it. Because that cranks. That can actually get the mineral out, and soil comes after, comes later, but the lichens are the first arrivals.
You could smack a few sturdy snowballs in Mars, too, up and along.
You could. Maybe it's too big of a...
Hi, my name is Nick. I'm a physics and math student, one of the founders of this little thing. Am I speaking loud enough? Okay. Well, I was wondering... What you showed us was from 1991 and up to 1995. I was wondering what progress has been made in the last 11 years, if any, and if not much has been made, then why?
It turns out in any medium, almost like in evolution itself, when it becomes possible to do something, suddenly people do all the forms emerge within the computer hardware at the time. So it's like the first multiplayer game was in Maze War in the 70s, and it had first-person shooting, bots, everything, instant message in 1974, 75, all that appeared. And it's almost like when you get the burst of creativity, that first generation of people invent the whole medium in a few years, and then there's sort of a cruising thing that goes for a while, like, oh, that was really interesting, or now there's a new generation of people who rise up and say, I'd like to do that, and they kind of copy what was done before, and they can only make an incremental improvement on it. And that's happening now, actually, because in the late 90s, it was quite depressing. We put on two conferences, and the same speakers came to both conferences. It's like, wait a minute, nothing's going on. Now there's a ton of stuff going on. There's grids out there. There are people, the Darwin at Home experiment is happening. There's the soda race experiment. Because now you can put it over the web and have thousands of people running it at the same time. And we're starting an effort to try to do stuff inside Second Life that's biologically inspired. So it's a whole new generation, I think, is about to start in massive multiplayer gaming. I think we're just at that next generation now. Questions from...
Who's ready for the talking stick?
Talking stick.
I'm Tor. I'm also kind of vaguely involved when I remember. But my question was, you mentioned bringing a comet into Earth orbit. How exactly would you go about doing that? What would be the technology requirements to actually have that happen?
There's actually a couple of ways to do it, and you want to pick a comet that's not too big, because people will say, you know, in 1906 there was this big fireball in the sky over top of Siberia, and it blew up at almost ground level and flattened hundreds of square miles of trees, and it was actually a comet, they think, that came in. It was several hundred feet across. So it got deep down, it was burning up in the atmosphere, it got deep down and exploded and flattened all these trees. No one was killed. It was miraculously over Siberia. Maybe someone was killed, I don't know. It's called the Tunguska incident. And it was sort of shrouded in mystery for years, and what had happened. A herdsman in Mongolia wrote, I think there was this enormous fireball that went bluey over the horizon. It's a human witness. And so you'd have to choose an asteroid that wouldn't do that. If someone decided, like, I'm having a bad day with this country, I'm just going to, the project is now taken over by the military, and we're sending it to delivery, special delivery to this country we don't like. So you don't want to do that. So you make it small enough, like 100 feet or 75 feet across, and it'll just burn up. It'll be a nice light show, expensive light show. So no government of the world will be tempted to use it. So you pick that. You can do it a couple of ways. There's a way to actually park a spacecraft that, relative to the mass of the ice ball, is really fairly massive, maybe 3, 4, 5 tons, and have it co-orbiting and just constantly adjusting its orbit. And over a period of a couple of years, you'll change the orbit. You won't even have to touch the thing. It's called a gravity assist capture. And if it's already kind of going across the Earth's orbit, you'll gradually change it, and you do all the math. Because they can get spacecraft right to the right part of Saturn to drop a probe, they can do that, and you gravity assist it. Or you can actually stick a thing on the end of it called a mass driver, which chews off a little bit of it and puts in an electromagnetic rail gun and fires it out, just like the fast trains in Germany and Shanghai. They're driven by that, the push-pull magnets. And you have a big solar array on it. Throw a bit of it out the back end, and you create a reaction force, and you can really power it into the orbit you want by using some of its mass. So rather than using expensive rockets and stuff like that. Of course, you could chew up some of the material, make get hydrogen oxygen out of it, and fill your tanks, and then fire your rockets every once in a while. Just use its material. There's lots of ways to capture one of these things. The problem would be is if you're in the with the Deep Impact mission that many of you saw. They were going alongside. They dropped that collider, that impactor, and went in. They figured that they created a great big plume, and they flew through it and found out it was made of. But the whole thing is really crusty and really porous. It's like pumice. It's just very, very. So you can't actually grab on. It may be that you can't grab onto them. And if they're close in to Earth, they're going to be burning material off like crazy. So you not only have to get it into Earth orbit, you have to get it in shadow. You have to put something up that will completely keep it in darkness to keep it from burning up. Otherwise, we would be coming out at night saying, oh, the project really failed because there would be a tail behind this thing. It would be a comet in orbit. And it would be like, call the congressional committee because our investment's burning up. Any other...
So it seems to me that as technology and processors and processing technology gets faster and faster, Essentially, what it allows you to do is express a complex system with simpler and simpler sets of rules. Essentially, physics, I'm Danny Key, I'm an astrophysics major. And it seems like a lot of physics is specific applications of more broad laws. So essentially, you can use processing power as kind of a way to express or have the computer do the complicated applications, and you can simply give it more and more simple sets of laws. But at the same time, as you create more and more complex system based on more and more simple sets of laws, it kind of goes back against the purpose, because as you get more and more complex systems, those systems become more and more dependent on chance and more dependent on random interactions. So essentially, do you find that there's kind of a theoretical limit where adding more processing power actually becomes, if anything, detrimental, because it provides a more perfect universe, whereas it's more important that the universe become less and less perfect, and where it becomes less and less a accurate model of the universe because of the fact that the universe becomes less and less uniform as it becomes more and more complex? I hope I phrased that well enough.
It's a complex question, and here's an example, which is a really plain, everyday example. It's called the jamming problem. And if any of you have cats and dogs, and you buy big bags of cats and dog food, but of course you have to dispense it into some tub or something, right? Because if you open it up and feed it, the cat will get on it and the dog will tear the bag apart and whatever. It's a ridiculous problem. So you have to have a hopper, and you have to pour the cat food or dog food in some kind of a makeshift hopper. And all these particles are going down the hopper, and they jam up, and then the stuff pours over the edge. The dog goes nuts because they're used to this jamming problem. And it turns out the jamming problem has been a hugely hard problem to solve in bulk material handling and mining for generations. And every time they add more processor to simulate more of it, they actually go off course. It's like, we just simulated jamming we never see in nature. But that's really interesting behavior, but it's never witnessed. We simulated ourselves out of our reality. We're in alternate universe jamming problems. Like jamming will go along an axis and suddenly everything will come into a V, and it's like, I found the solution. I added more processors, but you found a solution to something that never happens. And that just simple thing of cat kibble, where it moves and how it gets jammed up in a hopper, is a good example of getting fooled. And in our work on lunar soil, lunar rover simulation, it's the same problem. If you can over-simulate and fool yourself. And it's almost like the low analog simulations are better, actually. They're more useful than the high detail ones. And if you're trying to do things in real time where you want to use that joystick and drive that vehicle, not wait 15 hours for it to render, you have to do a whole lot of corner cutting because you're using a game card and all you got is this. So you're doing all kinds of fakery to get the complexity. So you're creating, there's all kinds of tricks to create. It's fakes. It's all fakes. It's all smoke and mirrors. But Red Whitaker from Carnegie Mellon said, you're going down a slope and you're going like this, back and forth. You don't want to simulate that by having the wheels and the contact with the surface and having soil pile up. You know, that's what's really happening. Soil's piling up, and you have a virtual plow that isn't really on the vehicle, but it sort of sticks out the back, and it is a plow in the back. And the plow is a fake to simulate the back and forth motion down a wall where you're out of control. It's like, well, you can't do that, because there isn't a plow on any of these things. He says, no, but it's a good analog. It works in practice. If we run that, and you can do it cheap with cheap computing, you can actually do that kind of simulation and you just change the wheels on your, and your simulated plow shows how the wheels catch, and you go and you put it on a real slag heap and it works. So use the cheat. So I guess that's the short answer to that question.
Think of Taylor expansions, you know, after, like you can get an exact answer, or you can get an answer that's just accurate enough, I guess. Is that what you're saying? Like, I mean, you were suggesting something else, though. It sounded kind of confusing to me. You're suggesting that a more accurate simulation could yield less accurate results?
A more simulated situation can lead you to things that just don't ever occur in nature. It's like you're off course and nature's laughing at you saying, yeah, you're just so full of it. You know, you've simulated every grain and how it bounces off every other grain, and I'll show you. I'll give you complexity. You know, that's not how I work, nature. I do it another way, and you haven't found that way yet. So if you think you have, so you get all these, you get misled, and something up there is laughing.
It's probably emergent behavior.
Emergent behavior, which is never witnessed in nature. So it's like, oh, you're doing a cool art project, I see. That's what it comes down to.
It's the noise problem.
The noise problem.
It turns out a CD sounds bad. Well, it's the noise problem. It turns out a CD sounds better if you add half a bit of noise. Yeah. That's actually how they finally made them sound good.
Nick, our cosmic being is here. Do you have any questions? The cosmic being absorbing. One more question.
Since nobody's asked about, I'm Jeff Jones, the other moderator for this future salon. Since nobody's asked about this, the very end of your talk, and since I'm also a physics graduate student and work on cosmology type stuff and stuff of that nature, it interested me.
You're
although
a professional in this.
I'm wondering, well, it almost seems a little bit. Well, I noticed a lot of themes from Frank Tipler in there. I wonder if some of that is based on some of his ideas, Omega point theory, or
explain those for everyone.
Oh, the Omega point. Well, I guess Frank Tipler was a cosmologist. I actually don't know too much about his theory, but he had this was, I guess, mostly years ago. He came up with this theory that as the universe was crunching down to a big crunch, it sounded very similar to what you're saying, that there would be some single conscious being that could maybe take over. And I think he talked about it was more like a slowing down of time, like as its thoughts accelerated, it could think an infinite number of thoughts before the end, even though it would end in crunching. Mm-hmm. But what you were talking about was more avoiding the actual crunch by banging again.
Right.
But it seems kind of dated to me at this point, because there's mostly consensus that the universe is expanding. I mean, we know it's accelerating right now, so unless something drastically changes or we can have some. So I was wondering if you had any idea. It seems like the hard part to me would be actually stopping the acceleration,
right,
and turning it around so that
exactly
it did crunch.
And all that dark matter, we haven't heard from that yet. The dark matter may be, who knows, the dark energy, the dark matter. But yeah, that's the problem. And so in a sense, it's a two-phase process, because dispersed life has to do the engineering of saying it's worth stopping the expansion somehow, and then it's not going to be around to see the payoff. You know, it's just going to do the course correction, and then a lot longer in the future is the payoff, which is communications returns. But it's interesting that, you know, that the inflationary model is kind of a deflating thought, that it's all just going to evaporate and go to some kind of uniform quantum field, and it's all over until the next wiggle or something like that.
So I didn't introduce myself the first time. I'm Andy Rondo. Anyway, my question for you is, with all this sort of evolution of life forms inside of a computer, do you have any idea how long it'll be until one of these life forms actually cries when it knows that you're going to pull the power cord?
One of the visionary projects of the Biota Group was to have a prize, and we called it the Alive Prize. I think there's since been an Alive Prize announced by somebody. But I went to see two people to get their opinion on this. One was Danny Hillis, who created that cube computer. And he said, sounds like a great, because he's the perfect marriage of an engineer and someone who has a biology background. So what about this thing? He said, sure, it sounds like a good idea to me, but call it lifelike. Don't want to get all the controversy. Then I said, okay, he's not a controversy-seeking type person anyway, so I'm going to go to a controversial person. It was Richard Dawkins, and he spoke at our second conference in Cambridge. And so I went to have tea with him in his house, and I described the Alive Prize, and he said, great! It'll put it right to those creationists, you know. This was back in, I think, 99 or 2000. But his idea was that every year, and he said, count me in if you guys get this going. We haven't found a donor for the prize money yet, but I probably should go and ask the Google people or something. They're crazy enough to do this. You probably need about $10 million like the X Prize. But every year, the problem is it would be hard to win the prize. Every year you would have people submit entries, not in a common digital soup. It would be nice if it was a common digital soup, but and there's a panel of people that wouldn't all be biologists, but it would be philosophers, whatever, who would look at these synthetic ecosystems and say, oh, give that like a 7.2. So like the figure skating competition, like 6.4 or 7.2. They would sort of rate it in lifelikeness. And that sometime in, and I put a bet on long bets about this, that sometime like in, if of 20 years of doing this, someone like Dawkins, who is controversial and doesn't care what other biologists even think, say, I give this a 10. And I'll give it a Latin taxonomic name, and I'm gonna have my graduate students study its life cycle. I declare it to be a living thing, therefore. He won't have to say I declare it to be a living thing. It's interesting enough to study from a biologist's perspective, or a field ecologist, or whatever. And that'll be this critical moment, and then there the moral, and you're the next person, because I know you had the first question, but then you have this sort of obligation of, well, if you pull the plug on it, you know, have you killed a species? Have you violated the Endangered Species Act? What happened to us at the first biota conference was Digital Burgess. We went up to the Burgess Shale in Canada. I took 60 people up to this fossil quarry. They had to hike 3,000 vertical feet. And it was paleontologists who sit in front of microscopes and computer screens and do this to pieces of rock, and they were kind of rotund. So one of them walked on a treadmill for 6 months so he could make this hike. But we had a whole group of people up at the Burgess Shale. And I'm losing my train of thought. Where was I going with this?
The prize with Dawkins.
The prize with Dawkins.
Something controversial about creating...
Would it cry when you pull the plug? Well, we had a party the night after we got to and from the Burgess Shale, and Tom Ray was there. And if you know Tom Ray, he created a system called Tierra, which was sort of little abstracted forms that would fill all of a computer and a server and fill it up. And I was up in the lab at the Banff Center in Alberta, in the Rockies, and I was trying to FTP some files down. I was starting FTP sessions on these SGI machines, and they would start and then would suddenly get slow. And I would start more FTPs. I think there's something wrong on the network or whatever. And I would start noticing that they would get a pulse of like a few kilobytes out, and they would stop, and a few kilobytes, and they would stop. And I started writing this sequence. There was a pattern in there, and I would start another session, and it would change the pattern of FTP on the other machines. It's like, this is totally weird. How could an operating system do this? Now, how can a network behave like this? And I went down to the pavilion where our party was, and there was Tom. I said, hey, Tom, how'd you like the hike? And he said, fine. I said, there's something weird going on. I can't get this FTP things going. And he said, I'll be back. He went up to the lab, and he killed off the entire Tierra installation he'd put there, because he's very sensitive about Tierra eating all the resources. And came back, and I said, well, what happened? Well, Tierra, your FTP sessions were like black smokers on the bottom of, they were evolving creatures or evolving algorithms to get cycles and to steal them from those low priority FTP jobs. And as a result, you were seeing this pattern happening as Tier consumed all the resources and all the non-operating system processes were being competed out. And there were 20 or 30 species that evolved around this, and I killed the whole thing. because he doesn't want Tierra to be considered a virus and wreck people's networks and stuff. So that's the sort of a, they didn't scream when they were killed, but he took a dump of them to take back so he'd have a fossil record. So that was an interesting, and there we go.
I had kind of two related questions, actually. The first one is, so you keep talking about trying to recreate systems that represent the world in computers and in these simulations, but how have you found anything interesting in trying to recreate systems which aren't necessarily based on the reality that we know of, and essentially letting those run and seeing if it actually, given completely different parameters, ends up creating anything similar to what we see? And then also as an extension of that, have you found that any sufficiently complex system with any specific set of rules eventually starts creating something like a system or some system similar to life or similar to something along those lines?
Well, the interesting thing was that Tierra, you know, what you saw with Carl Sims' blocky creatures was a kind of real physical type thing with a ground plane and water and everything, kind of like the physical world. Tierra was very abstract. There was no virtual world for Tierra. It was just compute space. So it was in a kind of a medium hard to understand mentally. And what happened with Tierra, as a result, there was all these bizarre effects that would happen, like a colony of Tierran organisms would grow, fill up all the compute space, and they would, what Tom wrote was a little thing that would allow the progenitors, the mothers, to determine servers out there in the universe that had more energy, they had more processor. And so they would send all their offspring there. But what happened initially was the offspring would all go to a big fat server somewhere that had lots of CPU, and he called it the Club Med. So all these young people arriving in this hot environment, and they would reproduce way too fast and burn it up, and basically it would become inaccessible really quickly. So over time, the Tierran mothers stopped sending the offspring to the Club Med servers anymore. And so that's something that's completely unpredictable and really hard to understand because it was in the abstract sort of cyberspace realm.
Were the beings bit strings?
They were all bit strings. And the second question was?
Do you find that any sufficiently complex system with a certain set of parameters eventually starts exhibiting features similar to life or similar to something along those lines?
I think that there's whole gradations because you could...
You want to repeat the question?
Oh, any...
Wasn't another talking stick?
Any sufficiently complex system that has simple rules and a lot of ways to recombine them? I don't think so. I think that certainly in life itself, I mean, in chemistry, I mean, chemical reactions have, there's a ton of chemical reactions that go on in solution that aren't life, but they exhibit pretty phenomenal emergent properties. And there's this whole layers. And I think for the most part, you know, pretty much every, one could argue that there's never been a computer-based system that's really exhibited true lifelike properties, and that we're at the stage of chemical solution, of chemical baths, and we're getting interesting stuff, but it's not really, it just never meets the grade as a truly lifelike system, because it's too simple. You know, there was a, I think in the 50s or 40s, there was someone who had built this system of wooden blocks. I don't know if you guys have seen this in computer science classes, and these wooden blocks, actually, this guy, it was in the 40s, I think. It was a Brit. It always is a Brit doing things like this. But he actually showed how if you kind of push the blocks around, they would kind of get caught up in each other and assemble these structures. And the way you push them, they would sort of self-assemble. And clays, when clays are being deposited and they're being moved physically, they can create alignments that almost look like structure formation. There's another... and in waves, when waves break down, like down here in Santa Cruz, all those bubbles that are forming, little temporary vacuoles are formed, and then inside there's a little activity that happens, but it's, you know, maybe life started that way. But there seems to be, there's an ability almost anywhere in the universe, probably in any computing system, to get things that kind of remind you of organization, self-organization. But then they never break through chaos and second law of thermodynamics, where something comes and sweeps in and some big wash of water comes over and they're all gone. Whereas life seems to be able to hang on despite getting a huge amount of infusion of energy or vibration or shock or temperature change. And I think that's probably that's the litmus test for lifelikeness is, yeah, that looks good. Now let's really shake it up. Is anything still there in the sandbox? Shake it up.
I was wondering, how hard is Ray's code like to recreate and to modify? I mean, like, why haven't any hackers made like self-modifying viruses, for instance, or useful programs or anything like that? Like, why haven't they applied this to very simple spreading programs?
So the question would be, and that's a very good question, why hackers crack open A-Life books and say, hey, we've learned everything we need to know. Well, I think it's because, you know, hackers have human goals. They have this abstract goal of cracking a network or depositing a file in a certain place or installing an ActiveX control. And so their goals are very directed. And also the environment that they're working in is very limited and very fragile. Whereas what Tom Ray's environment was and what Carl Sims' environment was were beautiful open-ended things that were protected that allowed you to have a protected virtual machine to do a whole lot of stuff. And it's almost like you have to set that up. You can't make that happen in AJAX space or in an FTP server. There's just not enough. There's not enough dimension in there. So yeah, they were better than FTP at optimizing. They were better, but they were the Tierra virtual machine was really good at running at a high priority process. Was very good at adapting its compute needs over time. So it was like a compute soaker, whereas FTP was this dumb little thing saying, I'm at a low priority and I'm making requests. I'm being pulled or something. I make a request constantly. It was a dumb robot. Whereas the Tierra virtual machine was like, oh, there's this thing that keeps bugging the CPU and I can slip in and I'm higher priority and I can ask for more compute in a slightly more complex pattern and I can get it. And so its collective action was a smart blob, whereas FTP was this firing robot. So that's a very good, but the smart blob needed a whole incredible protected soup to work and lots of CPU and sort of a protected guarded area, like a walled garden really. That makes.
So I was just wondering, what do you think the potential of these techniques are to evolve something more intelligent than, you know, bacteria analogs or little critters, but something with maybe some self-awareness or, you know, something you could have a conversation with, you know, not starting from scratch, you know, but, you know.
So the question was, these techniques, what do I think of them evolving something with self-awareness? I think there's probably zero potential. I think that it's like going back to Earth in, you know, 1.8 billion years ago and talking to the stromatolites. You know, they said, you know what? We love the fact you're talking to us because you're giving us CO2, but we don't like, you know, come back at night when we need it. That's all we do. We're just a factory. We make oxygen. We outgas. We do. And they would have said, and we were going to hold our fifth conference at the stromatolite colony. And what they say locally in Australia in this little bay is if you go down on the beach and you lie down at night, you can get high on the oxygen. They are cranking so much oxygen. They're so efficient. You can kind of get this sort of oxygen high from them. So, and it turns out that 300 million years ago, there was 30% more oxygen in the atmosphere, so swamps burnt violently. Wet vegetation burned with violence. And we're in a period of declining oxygen. So this great legacy that was pumped into the atmosphere is now declining. It's gradually getting bound into rock and stuff. So I think it's just so long. The best you can do, you know, you could say in a lifetime of computing, if I ran this simulation for 50 years nonstop of the biggest grid, will I get something that'll emerge that, you know, well, if you got something that was as complex as a locusts, you know, or something that had a true body and it had a true environment. You know, you might get that in 10 years. But I think accelerated evolution, you know, maybe that's why we're making computers in the first place. Because Nate, you know, here's another wacky theory. Mother Nature's saying, oh dear, we only have 600 million years of life on land before it gets too hot on the continents. And we've got this tomb called the gravity well. Every time you try to throw something out of the gravity well, it falls back down. And eventually, the sun will get into this red giant stage. By that time, there will be no oceans anyway. There'll be single-celled organisms, and the Earth will burn up and break up and enter the sun's atmosphere. We're gone. So nature's saying, got to get out of here. You know, did all this work to get all this complexity. Got to get out of this tomb called the gravity well. Well, there's very few ways you can do that. Because chemical rockets, you lift a certain amount of mass, and it tends to dry out, blow up, or, you know, the mass is the wrong kind of protoplasm. But there's another way to get out of the gravity well, which is to take everything down into information and transmit it. And in the Galileo, and I showed Galileo, I didn't give an example, but in the Galileo mission, I remember being at JPL when they were packing it up to go in, and you could see this beautiful high-gain antenna. And the mission was slingshot around Venus a couple times to pick up enough gravity assist to get to Jupiter. But on the second time around, I think it was, they coming back, they tried to open the big antenna, they couldn't. And one guy I talked to said, oh, it's a catch. It was like this cable tie and the thing just caught on it, and that's it. Another guy said, no, it was warping due to coming toward the sun two rounds, it warped the dish. So it could not. So now they have a crippled spacecraft going to Jupiter, $2 billion. Big thing. So what do? They say, okay, it's either a dead mission and we all lost our jobs, or we're going to transmit software, we're going to make better software so that when it gets to Jupiter, using just a little pizza pie dish, very low capacity, we're going to change its brain en route and write software and change its whole vision system and everything, and they did that. So by the time it got to Jupiter, it was a functional mission again. But they transmitted a whole new set of capabilities to the spacecraft. They did engineering on the fly. And that's a sign for the future of the life that lives off of the Earth will have this ability to transmit maybe its genomic information as data or fundamental communication. We'll use that mechanism because we kind of use it here like bats, and we use it inside a gas, but you got to do it outside of a gas. And so perhaps life or Gaia or the planet has evolved us to create culture, to create computers, to create this abstract medium where life can be around for a while, where it can evolve faster. And we do robotics and other stuff, and just by making cool NASA multiplayer games and robot toys, we create this mechanism to get these things that can actually go out and have their brains transmitted, their building plans or how they operate transmitted, because they don't weigh anything. Once you get a receptor out there that's a factory to make stuff, all you have to do is send the plans. So that may be like life is going, come on, guys, you know, that Intel processor, oh, no, bad choice. Well, we'll work with that. Now we got 80 cores, you know, 80 cores. Yeah, now we're talking. Remember the connection machine? It had 1,000. They're talking about 1,000 core single core duo. No, it's going to be core 1,000. So, you know, nature's going, cool, core duo, you know, stock price should go up. You know, keep Intel going or AMD or whoever it is and keep those developers going and all the, you know, massive multiplayer gaming. Yeah, you know, business success, World of Warcraft, that's our next step. Yes, go. You know, it could be. You know, it's like, why are we doing all this? You know, continuing on, get out of the death trap. Another wacko theory.
So talking about life sort of being based off software and sending it out into space, I'll turn the question around. How soon until we find the monolith?
Well, we put the monolith in one of our Avatars events. You had to actually go and find it on a virtual moon. It was really funny. But, yeah, I think unfortunately, probably... we're not going to find a monolith. It would be good to think that we could.
The monolith is abstract.
The monolith's abstract. I think the monolith's all around us. The miracle of existing. There's a book being sold in
Extraterrestrial intelligence.
Well, you know, I think it may go the other way, more the other way, that the universe, that, say, for instance, you did find an evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence, it's like, we'd probably give up. We'd say, it's a done deal. They have better technology than us. And all they, there's a science fiction story years ago, I think it was Niven and Pornell, it sounded like Niven and Pornell, where E.T. found Earth. They evaluated everything we had done and then said, nothing's valuable except one thing, gambling. Gambling was brand new. There was no other civilization to come up with it. So they set up all these spaceports near Vegas and Atlantic City, and aliens would come down, and they had to make, you know, multi-arm bandits because these guys had lots of arms. And gambling, and the gambling addiction was the only sole contribution to culture, and everything else was sort of a done deal. So we at least had some industry, a tourism industry as a result. But I have a feeling that we're not going to, if we find E.T., if you talk to Seth Shostak, who's also in that History Channel show, he's another, he does a much better job of this. We're going to just find signals. We're going to find transmissions. We're not going to see anything. And that's going to be an interesting, if we do it, I mean, at the rate that they're building receivers, you know, they've got a 10 million channel receiver over at the SETI Institute, or a 50 million, 100 million channel receiver. Now, he does the math, and he says, we're scanning this part of the sky, and we have a billion channel receiver, and it's just, he does show these curves where if there is a transmitter on, we're going to find it in my lifetime, and, you know, the next 30 years of his lifetime. He really thinks that they are. And with the Allen Array up in Northern California, where they're building the multi-dish Allen Array. But if we find that, how's it going to affect us? Because we're probably not going to see ships. We're going to get a It might be just a carrier wave.
What if it's a satellite?
Like in Contact, Sagan's book.
I really doubt if it'll be a... I mean, I can't. I have no opinion on this, but I think... I doubt if it'll be a physical artifact. Because
In Contact, it was a signal, though.
It was a signal.
Yeah.
But then eventually someone got taken to a beach and met her dad. And right. And government contractors would never have built those. So I can tell you right now.
It seems like even if we just received a signal, it would be very valuable to learn about an alien culture and see what sorts of technology they have. Who knows how much you could infer from just a signal, but if it's characteristic of their society, maybe we could learn, move out of our own culture into something more general or more, I don't know, I see it as being valuable.
I think that the hope would be that if we got a signal, we would for a moment halt and look at all our petty things that we're doing and say, you know, guys, it's worth staying around so we can see to get the answer of what they're like, or try to communicate with them. So it can take decades to get something there and back again. And so can we just hold off on the wars for a while and hold off on the population, manage the planet, because we got something to live for. We send a message saying, you know, come to the party, but it's going to take 50 years and none of us are going to be around. You know, or we'll probably go, oh, interesting, and then go back to our normal, you know, normally scheduled programming. You know, so that could be, I would hope that it would kind of stop the madness just for a brief moment, or create a new kind of a madness.
At the very least, it would be inspirational.
Be inspirational to a few nerds, I guess.
I guess we're kind of on a tangent, but I feel like a lot of this is all tangents. But I don't know. I think if we found, like, if contact were to happen, you say the government wouldn't contract it, but I think it would be kind of like having the secret to the A-bomb. Like, the government might say that they're not doing it, but everyone would want it. Everyone would want the secret, and eventually someone would make it. And eventually, a whole bunch of governments would struggle to make it.
To make what? Blueprints for a thing, or something like
that. Blueprints for a thing,
yeah. I think we're sort of in the realm of science fiction at this point.
You're assuming they would send us blueprints.
Yeah. Oh, well. See, this is the difference between British and American science fiction. In British science fiction, the blueprints would be something completely hilarious and stupid that you'd only see at the very end. It would be some practical joke, whereas the American science fiction has to be a serious thing. It might be a practical joke. It may be a test to see, you know, something. Or the message that, you know, if you, you know, you're part of the universe, you're a life form, you're obviously aware, get, you know, get your act together and survive. That's all you got to do. Don't kill each other. Don't wreck your home. Try to calm down. Because we're like this young species. It's like this teenage boy at 13 full of testosterone, and it's shooting, and it's doing everything it can. It has like 90% stupidity and 10% maybe potential for wisdom. And these juvenile delinquent species, there's probably some global Google that as soon as a signal comes in, oh, juvenile delinquents. So there's a standard reply in the great Google search engine that says, okay, here's the page that comes back. Number one, you know, stop killing each other. Number two, value all life in your world. You know, number three, you know, yeah, think long term, think beyond your lifetimes, and et cetera, and checkbox, and you push submit. And if you submit the form and you don't even know how, you don't even understand the question, but they might just have a standard answer, or not another one.
42.
And 42. But it would be like civilizations like that are so advanced and so long-lived that for them we would just be another curiosity of like, another one. Okay, that's, you know, 75 in this part of the galaxy, and they have a, you know, they might be quite amazed by us because they say, these buggers, they've had 4 billion years of stability. Their sun hasn't been a variable. They've had this constant temperature. You know, they've had several mass extinctions, and they've resulted as a result. They've kind of come and do a survey, and they say, these are lucky sons of whatevers. They've had such a stability, and they haven't realized how hard it is for most sentient beings to evolve. And they've been had this sweet place. And look at them. There's a joke that I tell at the Mars meetings, which is, there is life on Mars now. It's the bacteria that's inside the Mars exploration rover, inside the casement, and in where the wiring harness is. Because there's a room at JPL that's all dried out. And it was dried out so that it wouldn't contaminate the vehicle. And as a result, you've got these beautifully evolved single-cell bacteria there. They're evolved for Mars. Dry and cold. And so they're in there, and they were on Viking too. And, you know, over time, the radiation just kills them off. But they're actually in there. And, in fact, the Mir space station, one of the reasons they dumped it in the ocean, was covered with mold on the inside. It was just unbearable. Just absolutely on the inside, just covered in mold. Everything was mold, and it was very unhealthful to be there. So Mars exploration rovers are trundling along, carrying all this bacteria. My theory is that when they landed, they bounced on the airbags, and they got off the... They drove off. The bacteria on the Mir rovers reported back to the bacteria in the crust and said, we're back. And here's what happened. You know, piece of Mars, you know, this is the whole story. Piece of Mars got blown off. It had single-celled life in it. The chunks landed on Earth 4 billion years ago. They evolved. And here's what we evolved. It's water and oceans and everything was totally out of control. And they polluted the frigging atmosphere, everything crashed and burned, and then the guys, these hyper juveniles got the oxygen thing, and they made these huge organisms. And then we said, oh no, not huge organisms again. Well, we're going to evolve them with lots of appetite and big guts, so at least they'll carry us around. So fishes and then things on land, and this, these big scaly things evolved, and they never looked up in the sky. They were always like focused on eating stuff on the ground, so we ordered a strike. So strike came in, wiped them all out. We're running out of time, you know, the clock here, because the continents are getting drier and the sun's getting hotter. And so we had one more shot. We picked these, this is the second shot, we'll pick these primate things. And they were insectivores living in trees. So we picked them, and they've evolved up, but it's a total dead deal. Because they've invented spacecraft. They carry lots of them in the gut. And we're back, and we're saying, this is never going to work out. We're ordering another strike. Because we're going to try again. We picked this thing with an external exoskeleton this time. And it's going to do it because it's a sensible, they will be sensible. They will work as a colony. They won't be very creative. There will be no, but they'll get there. And their spacecraft will be self-maintaining bodies. And it'll be the cockroach. We've chosen the cockroach for the third time. We've only got 300 million years left. Plants getting hot. The cockroaches will be fine. Give us a strike. So the Mars bacteria are like, all right, incoming, you know, here we go. So that's my theory about The bacteria rule. I mean, they're everywhere and they rule. We're in the age of bacteria.
What's your project you're currently doing the second? You mentioned that you were doing something with Second Life. I wanted to know what that was.
And this will be the last comment, because I think everybody needs to go elsewhere. What we're trying to do in Second Life is a guy named Jeffrey Ventrella. If you know him, he made Darwin Pond, and he worked at there, and he's a... Sorry?
He has the sidewalk.
No, it's a different Ventrella. But the whole... We did a project called Nerve Garden about 10 years ago, which was take Lindenmeyer systems, and these are mathematical formulations of strings that replace other strings, and you have a string this long, and it will grow a plant that looks like a wild mustard. It's perfect. Or you'll grow a tulip or a rose or something. And these are just simple strings replacing each other. And you say A and B replace with C, and C is a stem. And you can grow plants. And we did this at a conference called SIGGRAPH, which you guys probably know about. And the idea was animals are pretty hard to do, but plant growth is interesting. I mean, plants came kind of before, you know, everything. And they'll be here after animals are gone. And so we're trying to figure out how to grow a garden inside Second Life, where it won't be just grow something out, stick it there, and it doesn't ever change. Where the plants that are there change over time, and they're collecting energy. There's tropism. There's even topiary effects of people cutting them off, chopping them off, because you can actually chop part of an L system off and have it grow around a cut stem and stuff, just to get people thinking. Because there's a lot of people who like gardening, and gardening happens on a slower time scale than a dog. And so it doesn't take as much compute cycles to do it. And I've always thought, that's why we did Nerve Garden. We did it in Vermal, and it was single user. I've always been looking for a place to plant a garden. And it seems like Second Life may be the place. Or World of Warcraft. But it's too slow for World of Warcraft. It's not an open platform. And Second Life has an open API to do stuff. And hopefully you don't grow too many polygons that it hoses the frame rate. So you got to... It's already hosed. It's by some content.
Actually, yeah. I know you're going to mention that.
So I think that this is probably time to wrap this one up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.